I'm Robin D.G. Kelly. And this is Errol Garner Uncovered. Who is Errol Garner to you?
Everyone knows he's a virtuoso. I mean, I think no one could question that at all. But how many people are virtuosic at every level? You know, it's like some people would fall back and he pushed harder, you know, and it takes a lot of courage to do that. When the 3D reality cannot provide you with what you need to have this space within the imagination, the space within sound that's not a physical space, but it's a realm, an alternative world where you can really be yourself. We just don't have a voice like that. I mean, no one really has, to me, like, continued that avenue that he's taken us down on all those levels at the same time. You know what I mean? It's an amazing legacy.
I'm Pete Lockhart, senior producer for Octave Music. On this episode of Errol Garner Uncovered, Robin E.G. Kelly is joined by the incredibly talented Nicole Mitchell. Together, they explore Garner's 1970 release, Feeling is Believing, an adventurous album with an even split of Garner's new original music, alongside his bold arrangements of contemporary pop classics like For Once in My Life and The Beatles' Yesterday. Here's your host, Robin E.G. Kelly.
So, Nicole Mitchell, it is an honor and a privilege to have you as my guest on Errol Garner Uncovered. And I should say that you're a very special guest. You have been appointed the William S. Dietrich Chair and Director of Jazz Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, which is the home of Errol Garner's papers. And also, you are stepping up to fill the huge shoes of our dear friend, pianist composer Jerry Allen, who, you know, before she tragically left us way too early, directed Jazz Studies at Pitt. And, you know, those are big shoes to fill, but I can't think of anyone on the planet who can fill them better than you. And I say this from a place of knowing, because for me personally, Eric Dolphy, James Newton, and you completely changed the way I think about the flute as an instrument. And as a composer, you know, your work interrogates and absorbs ideas from everywhere. Jazz, experimental music, surrealism, Western new music, literature. And yet you always seem to stay grounded in the vernacular roots of Black music. And that, to me, makes you kin to Errol Garner. You were making Afrofuturist music before that term was even in vogue. And I think the first time I saw you perform live was with Anthony Braxton at the Iridium, where my dear friend Taylor Hall Bynum was in that band. And I remember it so vividly. It's like one of the most unforgettable moments of my life with this music. But of course, I followed your career since your recordings with David Boykin, your own Black Earth Ensemble, the small group recordings with Hamid Drake, the Xenogenesis Suite, tribute to Octavia Butler, all that work, the Tiger Trio, your collaborations with Tamika Reid and Matthew Shipp most recently. And you're such a prolific and brilliant composer. And that's another connection to Garner, you know, thinking about him as a composer. But there's so much music to talk about, you know. But anyway, welcome.
Wow, what an introduction.
I cut it short, actually, because there's so much to say about you. And I'm such a big fanboy, as you know.
Well, likewise, I'm a huge fan of you. And it's like a huge honor to have this conversation with you. You've been such an inspiration.
Well,
with all the work that you've been doing. And I just hope I do some justice here in this interview.
Oh, no, on the contrary. Well, let's begin where I always begin with my guests. And that is, who is Errol Garner to you?
A master in so many counts. Because, first of all, just with the first note you hear his heart. He has such a huge heart. It's infectious, and like he just pours love from his fingers. And that is the most, to me, one of the most important things about an artist. Like, can they touch a person? Can you feel them? And he is so generous. I've never even met him, but I know I can feel his generosity. And then to be on all levels, like taking it to the highest point in terms of his rhythmic sensibilities, mm-hmm. his, I mean, literally, yes, this is a percussion instrument, which we somehow forget with other piano players, but the heights that he takes the rhythmic aspects to the music hits me first. And then, like, the genius of his, like, harmonic understandings and translations and transmutations and expansions, especially in this context where he's working with, you know, compositions by others and, like, bringing them to a whole nother experience for listeners, songs mm-hmm. that they may be familiar with, but, like, really expanding our experience in those songs. Right. And right. then the innovation as an improviser. I mean, everyone knows he's a virtuoso. I mean, I think no one can question that at all. But how many people are virtuosic at every level?
Right. In terms of, exactly. You know?
And we just don't have a voice like that. I mean, mm-hmm. no one really has, to me, like, continued that avenue that he's taken us down right. On all those levels at the same time.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? It's an amazing legacy, and yeah. the younger people need to be touched by him, and we need to find avenues for exposure.
Right, right. Well, you know, I found it so interesting that the first adjective you used was generous. Generosity. That's not a term we always think of when we think of musicians, and yet it's so apt. It's so important to be generous as a musician, and we forget about that. So one of the songs that we definitely wanted you to speak on is Mood Island. Mood Island is, you know, Earl Garner's original. And, you know, we thought about you because it has been identified or described, classified as a kind of Afrofuturist tune.
Utopic.
Yes, utopic. You know, it was, there was Garner's 1944 Overture to Dawn, which was recently included in the exhibition on Afrofuturism in Brooklyn. And Garner himself was presented with a group of writers and artists and musicians who in that exhibition were kind of active between 1920 and 1960 as the pioneers of Afrofuturism.
A place where we can be free. You know, I think about what William Parker talks about with the sound world and this idea that really helped me to have music as a home when the 3D reality cannot provide you with what you need to have this space within the imagination, the space within sound that's not a physical space. But it's a realm, an alternative world where you can really be yourself.
Thank you.
really so moved by his like the way he flies. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see it as like flight, like when he improvises. And it's not like free flight where we have no, like where it's abstract, but it's always mm-hmm. within our language of knowing, but like it's like this dexterity like Michael Jordan or something, you know what I mean? But it's just like, no,
yeah, well, that's Errol Garner is Michael Jordan, except that he's more generous.
Yeah, exactly. In music, you can have you can have safety, you can have freedom, you can have space to express yourself, and you can be with others, and it's. No one can do anything to harm it because it's right. not physical. You know what I mean?
Exactly. You grew up in a household. Your mother was an artist, right?
Mm-hmm. Self-taught. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was your relationship to the music in your household coming up and to art? Or more specifically, did you ever hear Garner's music growing up as a kid?
Unfortunately, my parents must not have been aware of him. My parents loved Ahmed Jamal. Mm-hmm. They loved Ramsey Lewis. And my dad was a very big fan of classical music, but he didn't necessarily buy albums of classical music. He just kept the radio on. Whenever we were not home, he would just put it on a classical station. So when I came home, I would be hearing a lot of things that mm-hmm. and really got an understanding of classical music history through the radio right. more than anything else. My mom loved soul and R&B, and you know, so it was like it was a big mix of music right. But unfortunately I hadn't been introduced to him as a child. I would have mm-hmm. yeah, I would have loved to, because we did have a piano in the house, and I, you know, dibbled and dabbled on it a little bit but that would have been amazing.
But flute was your instrument from the beginning?
No, I actually started on viola.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I started on viola, and then the next year they brought the wind instruments, and I was like, wait a minute, what is that? What is that? And my parents were like, too bad, we already bought a viola. We're not doing this. So I played air flute for 4 years and listened to the radio, pretended to play flute.
Wow. So when you headed off to your UC San Diego, right, in Oberlin?
Yes, I started at UC San Diego. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, my experience in Anaheim, it was definitely ruptured with a lot of hostility, racial mm-hmm. hostility and rejection, I would say. So I wanted to get as far away from California as I possibly could after that experience, but my dad was like, nope, have to stay in the state. So that, as far as I could get away was right. San Diego.
Mm. And I understand that San Diego, you studied with Jimmy Cheatham?
Yeah. So I was roller skating around playing Mozart. Hadn't really been exposed to the idea that I could be a jazz musician, because in high school I just played in the orchestra, wind ensemble, and probably because of my instrument I was never even invited to audition for the jazz. They had a jazz group, but they didn't mm-hmm. I wasn't considered like, oh, that's not for you kind of thing. And so I really didn't know until Jimmy Cheatham that this was a possibility, and I was a little bit upset about that, to go to go without being told that this is a possibility, that you can develop your own language, you can improvise, you know. This was a real huge transformation for me to meet James Newton in Jimmy Cheatham's class.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, Jimmy Cheatham sent me straight to the library to listen to Hubert Laws, Eric Dolphy, and all the, you know, James Moody.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, you went to Oberlin, right?
In Oberlin, I met Donald Byrd. So when I first went to Oberlin, it was amazing because Donald Byrd was subbing for Wendell Logan. And he just opened up everything. Like, he was completely committed to giving whatever he had. Like, it was me and one other student. We would, like, be up till midnight in the conservatory with him practicing. And, you know, he was a great introducer. He was like, right. You know, you're just starting, but, you know, you got a lot of potential. He called me Frizzy.
So when you were at Oberlin studying with Donald Byrd and others, were you then committed to playing, you know, improvisational music and composing? I mean, is that how you saw your work and also who were you listening to in those days?
I was always listening to Ornette Coleman and Eric Dolphy and John Coltrane, you know, and Albert Eiler and Sonny Rollins. And, you know, I felt that I was always attracted to the musicians who were free spirits, mm-hmm. you know, who developed their language in the moment, you know, and had that stream of, you know, like a stream of consciousness and elasticity, mm-hmm. and also able to navigate different, you know, musical terrain and environments. Right. And I was a big fan of Jerry Allen too. I was introduced to her music, I think, right when I moved to Chicago in 1990. I just was obsessed. Like, when I first, like, heard her music, it was just really overwhelming to me. And as a role model, too, just looking up to her as like, a hero, you know? Mm-hmm. I just listened to, you know, her music over and over again. And it was amazing. I'm thankful that I had the opportunity to end up connecting with her, mm-hmm. working with her, and doing a little tiny bit of playing with her. But she's great inspiration.
Wow. I want to talk a little bit about Chicago. Chicago seems to be an important place, both for you, but also for Earl and for Martha Glaser. Just some context. I mean, Chicago is where Earl recorded Misty and recorded the record up in Earl's room. He plays his last ever performance there in February 1975 at Mr. Kelly's. He's always at Mr. Kelly's. They loved him there. Martha Glaser actually worked for the city of Chicago in 1944 for the mayor's Human Rights Commission, which is looking into things like, you know, police violence. So there's an interesting connection and synergy there. And for you, I know you got there and you were hanging out with old radicals like Haki Madhubuti and people who I love so much. Which is not necessarily like the trajectory of people who we conceive of as, like, you know, great musicians. Can you talk about, like, the impact that had on you and what you were doing in terms of development of your own music?
Chicago is where my mom was born and raised, on the South Side. And so growing up, that was my real feeling of home, especially after moving to California. I loved my experience in Syracuse. And when we moved to Anaheim, I just did not fit at all, and I could not find a space where I felt safe or a part of something, you know. So I was thankful that in the summers I could spend time with my grandparents on the South Side. And so I always had this love for Chicago, and I always said that when I was an adult that I would move to Chicago. And especially when my mom died when I was 16, and she really didn't get to continue her journey as an artist to really share her work the way she wanted to. So I really wanted to continue her journey and, you know, get to the places she didn't get to go to. And going to Chicago was another way of connecting with her, too, like for me. And just to be immersed in a Black community where it's so big that mm-hmm. diversity within the community is not a big deal. It's like there's all kind of Black folks. Like there it's no surprise. Like it's right. no big deal. There's, you know, you're not a weirdo and oddball. I mean, it's the home of the ACM. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. So Black experimentalism is something that's embraced as part of the culture, and that's very important, you know, to not be put in a box or not to have to be in a box where you can find other young people, other elder people as well that have this vision of trying new things and exploring new territories. And that was really perfect. It was a perfect booth for me to finally be a part of a community where I could thrive, you know. And musically, it's interesting, but you said, like, because working with Hakeem Adebutu wouldn't be the expected move for a musician. And at first, I didn't really find that many musician friends. Like, first, all my friends were, like, visual artists, writers, and filmmakers. You know, a lot of my friends went to the Art Institute. And I was like the only musician in our circle. It was like a lot of poets. You know, there was a, it was like the time, a really big time for Black spoken word and poetry. And, you know, there were lots of spots where there were, you know, poetry nights, poetry slams and things like that. And I was more in that crowd than I was in the jazz crowd. I would go, like, even when I went to visit in the summers, though, I would go, I would try to go to the new apartment lounge. And that was really when I decided, like, I'm going to be a jazz musician. I think I was underage and I had a date and we, like, snuck into the new apartment lounge. And my grandparents' house was right down the street from Chicago State. So I would go down there and Bunky Green was teaching and he would put me in the trumpet section. And so, and so, like, these were, like, I mean, it was just like, I could just jump right in and people would say, oh, go over here, do this, try this. And the doors were open, you know, right, in Chicago. Right. And so, you know, Von Freeman was super welcoming. And I was like, wow, this is it. Like when I heard Von Freeman play, that was it for me. I was like, I want to be a jazz musician.
Wow.
And that was before I moved to Chicago.
Right, right.
But it took a while to find my musician friends once I moved. Yeah.
Right. Well, in some ways, you kind of grew up there part of your life in a certain kind of way. And that's really important. It's, you know, you're really grounded in a place like that, which is such a rich, rich terrain for art. And the recording feeling is believing, just for some context. It was made over three different sessions, you know, August 8th, October 7th, and December 2nd, 1969 in New York. And the last session, which yielded a number of amazing, beautiful songs, was recorded 2 days before the Chicago police killed Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, members of the Black Panther Party, in their sleep. And the recording was released in 1970, around the same time, just weeks after, two Black students, Philip Lafayette Gibbs and James Earl Green, were killed on the campus of Jackson State University in Mississippi while they were protesting the Vietnam War. So there's something about the fact that Earl's music is always described by certain critics as happy. And there's a distinction between being happy and being joyful. That you can be, that, you know, we come out of a tradition, as you know, where you can be joyful, you must be joyful, even in the face of sadness, in the face of tragedy.
Laugh to keep from crying.
Exactly, exactly. And joy is not just being happy, like you're not, you're ignoring it, but really embracing it and making it joy. And there was a, some, and I just have to say this, beautiful liner notes by Martha Glaser, where she says, Garner's performances on this record are totally improvised and express the inner man in an era of self-conscious attempts to communicate more fully by encounter methods, touch, vibrations, Garner always has expressed himself fully, naturally, and without inhibitions. And that is to say that to focus on his inner soul, his inner self, is not the same as saying he's happy, which is a kind of external thing.
It's resilience.
Yes.
You know, it's like you can't keep us down. I mean, I think what is so overwhelming, mm-hmm. maybe for non-Black folks, is like, man, they just keep going, mm-hmm. you know, and the creativity and the resilience, like, to show that strength in the face of the threats, you know, right. that are impending, you know, I mean, that's like basically what you just described, because like within that context, he, you know, it's like some people would fall back and mm-hmm. he pushed harder, right. you know, and right. it takes a lot of courage to do that, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like you're doing it through sonic energy. I mean, it's not with text or words that are saying exactly what you're trying to say, but the sound, the sonic energy of what you're putting forth has an impact on us, right. you know, and it's like to keep us, to bring us hope, I think, and to like have love be stronger than all this hate, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel that's really where he's coming from. Like I said, he has such a big heart, you know?
Right. That's so beautiful, and it's so perfect, because again, it shows an artist who's not disengaged, but very much engaged, and engaged both in terms of the social and political context, but also the cultural context. I mean, I have to say one of my favorite tunes on this is For Once in My Life.
Oh, I know. Errol, oh my gosh.
Errol, you know, records, you know, a song made popular by Stevie Wonder, you know, written by Ron Miller and Orlando Merton. And it was a song that, it started out as a ballad written for a female vocalist, you know, and then Tony Bennett recorded in 67. The Temptations did. Then Paul Williams sings it like Johnny Hartman. And then Stevie Wonder just
killed it.
Yeah, exactly. Just
blew the top off.
Blew the top off. And then Errol comes across, and then he plays it up tempo too. So,
do you feel a little bit of Monk in his introduction, or what?
I feel a lot of Monk everywhere in Garner. I think, you know, Monk loved Garner, and it was it was mutual.
I wasn't necessarily aware of their relationship, but I was like, he's saying something to Monk right here. This one is, first of all, his comping is like, it's like an engine. You know, I feel like I'm in a really nice car with the top back. You know, just like gliding on a really smooth road, like just feeling really good on a beautiful day. Like the way he's got that left hand going, I mean, it's just, like I said, he has so much strength and like rhythmic fluidity, you know.
such a funky song. And the thing that always surprised me is that, you know, when Stevie Wonder did his up-tempo version, Berry Gordy hated it and wouldn't release it.
Really?
Yeah, he had to fight to get it released, and it became a hit. You know, it took a year. So he recorded it, I think, summer 67, it took a year. And so, of course, that's the version clearly that Earl's listening to. And it's also, he moves it in some interesting ways, you know.
Yes, I love the way he also, he doesn't like dissolve the melody, but he keeps it close to us. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because it's just that melody. It's one of those that really is something special. You know, it's like people have memories for this song, you know, parts of their lives. And so to keep it close to his chest like that, like really, I think makes it powerful. And it's one of my favorite on the album, I have to, you know. And of course, like those songs that, I mean, this is more my generation, this song, you know. So it's like some of the songs I'm like, oh yeah, my grandma loved the song. And like now he took it to this other place, you know, from like the way I had heard it when they listened to it. But this one is like more like, yeah, like this is something I grew up with. And then to see his spin on it is like, whoa, like. I want to hear it again and again.
Right. One of the great things about this record is that he has a number of original compositions and a number of very contemporary, then contemporary compositions and songs that every jazz musician was being pushed by their label to record the Beatles. I mean, everyone. Mm. I mean, everyone. The Monk was being told, you need to record Beatles songs. And Earl did it. And he said, you know, both in interviews with a Swiss radio station. And in fact, we can even listen to this wonderful interview that he does. He talks about it.
Mr. Garner, what makes you play Beatles numbers?
Well, it's a funny thing. I only play numbers that I feel like I can do justice to. And when I say that is because you got to realize I'm not a singer. I'm more or less known as a hummer. So I figured that if I get a fitting form and I can kind of semi-hum it, then for me it's worthwhile playing. But I never play a number when it's completely hot. I mean that when everybody...
What do you mean by hot?
Well, I mean by when everybody's playing it, I wait till it cool off, then I try and see what I can do to it.
Mr. Garner, do you like the Beatles in general?
I like a lot of the things that the Beatles do in general. And not only that, I mean, I've been knowing them before they got popular.
Are there other groups in modern pop music? You know, I'm interested in pop music.
Yes, I like Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And I like the Dimensions, the Fifth Dimensions.
Yes.
And, quite a few groups that I like. And I don't get a chance to hear them too much, but, like, when I do get a chance and if they do something that I kind of dig, that I feel, then I try and see what I can do with it, you know.
Is there a difference between your music, jazz, and modern pop music?
Well, I don't say that there's that much difference because even if you play a modern pop tune, song, that's very popular, it can be played so many ways, and more or less what I do, I play it in a jazzy way, the way I look at jazz, with a beat, and if I feel like I want to add a little rock to it, then I just do that with the rhythm.
Do you think that music develops into something that comes together? I mean, serious music, jazz, pop music, that it all comes together to be just music?
Oh, definitely. I definitely believe that.
Thank you.
brought it down home, basically. He took it home. He took yesterday home and made it something that, like something familiar. You know, he took it to a place where it's like one of our memories, you know, and it's beautiful. And in the, he even changed the vernacular in terms of where the phrasing of the melody is. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes. Exactly.
Which I really love because that's what we do, you know.
Right. Yeah, that introduction, I mean, I heard Mary Lou Williams, that, that boogie-woogie thing that she does.
Yeah.
And then the fact that he does what so many great musicians do all the time is that he his whole improvisation is built on the melody. Like you said, he rephrased it, but the melody keeps coming back. The theme keeps coming back and makes such beautiful music, you know? It's amazing.
Yeah, and the Beatles version is more almost like a folk song, you know what I mean? And it's very straight, you know, and he really put the curves on it.
Right.
He swerved it.
Think about your work in relationship to some of these tunes, even his cover of like Yesterday and The Lick of Love, not because you cover tunes, but because there's something that's always very contemporary and connected and grounded in even your most experimental compositions. There's a connection to the people, you
know. Thank you for seeing that. I don't think everybody does.
I see it and feel it. I mean, but as the title goes, feeling is believing, you know.
Right, that's right.
So, one of the things that you're also known for is that you did run an independent label, that you have worked, you know, in realms where it's not big commercial labels. And yet, you know, for Garner, part of this whole project is about what happened when he and Martha Glaser broke from Columbia Records and formed Octave and formed an independent label. But what's interesting about this particular record, two things. One is that it was released under Octave, it was produced under Octave rather, but released under Mercury, which is the first time a big label came back to him in the same year that CBS re-released Concert by the Sea as Stereo. And so what happened was this particular record, Feeling is Believing, was nominated for a Grammy for Best Jazz Performance, but it was overshadowed by CBS's record marketing of Concert by the Sea. So it's an interesting kind of thing where, you know, here you have someone trying to fight for independence, but still within the shadow of this huge conglomerate. And wondering just from your experience, you know, both engaging Earl's music and also making your own music in a commercial context where you're trying to do something independent and free, but the odds are difficult. And especially, you know, in Chicago, working with the one of the oldest independent publishers, you know, Third World Press, you've seen so much of this.
What you described is so frustrating because, like, for him to be trying to emerge, like, with this independent label and then to have his own music compete with his independence because it's owned by, you know, this huge company. That's, you know, I'm in a space right now, I mean, talking about our moment today, where I really believe we need to create new infrastructures. I don't know if we can actually repair the infrastructures that we have. We need to create new infrastructures, but But then there's that question, are they going to just be competing with these older, bigger ones? And how do you do this? You know, but when I say infrastructure, I'm not talking about just a label, but like, you know, you're talking about who are those people that are publicizing the music? Who are the people that are writing about the music? Who are the people that are publishing the writing on the music? Who are the people publishing the album? You know, so it's not just the labels, but who are the venues that are presenting the music? Like, when you look at all of those people, there's a lack of diversity. There's a really serious lack of diversity that's basically been considered okay and accepted for way too long. And how do we actually restructure things to reflect the reality in the music? And like, with, you know, that's a challenge that I'm looking at that I don't see a solution to yet, but it's a huge daunting task. But people do, you know, they do one thing at a time. They do what they are able to do. And like you said, I had a label. That label was with David Boykin for my first, for my first three albums I put on that label, Dreamtime Records. And we learned a lot about the process doing that. But now things have changed so much. You have this whole online thing and Spotify, which artists don't get paid anything. So it's amazing that Earl Gardner is a great example of an artist, African American artist, that really did it. Like, he did some groundbreaking work in this struggle,
right?
You know,
right,
that we can learn from. And that archive is really valuable for that. Mm-hmm. Like, we definitely need more people to like expound on that journey that he took with Glazier.
Exactly. Just your role in terms of being part of the group of caretakers of Gardner's legacy. It's a huge responsibility.
It is.
And it's great. Of course, by Blood, Sweat, and Tears, one of Earl Garner's favorites. What an introduction.
It just makes me want to jump. I guess it brings out the child in me, too, because I was introduced to that song as a child.
It's also interesting, too, that, you know, when in Garner's interview, he says, you know, he waits for a song to cool down first.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Peggy Lee recorded in 69, Sammy Davis Jr., I think, soon after that. So it was hot. It was hot when he recorded
it. It was still hot.
It was still hot.
And he just burned it up.
He totally burned it. Totally.
Rhythmic complexity and the tempo just totally, like I said, burned it up, because, you know, when you first introduced to this song, my introduction to it as a pop tune on the radio, it was almost as if it was a children's song, like very simple and, you know, bring you a little bit at a time in terms of the story. And then he just spun it right off of the axle.
Yeah, that's so true, you know. But, you know, what's also interesting about the lyrics of the song is that it goes back to what we began with. And that is, you think about, you know, it's in some ways about tragedy, but making joy out of tragedies. Yeah. You know, what goes up must come down. Spinning wheel got to go around. Talk about your troubles, it's the crying sin. Ride a pain and pointy, let the spinning wheel spin. You got no money, you got no home. Spinning wheel all alone. Talk about your troubles, you never learn, you know. And in some ways, it encapsulates the moment, the period. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. And that carousel was, I think, an obsession for me as a child. This idea of life being this thing that's going around and around. I'm sure this song contributed to that idea that, like, we're really doing the same thing over and over again, and it's not working. Like, when are we going to get off and do something else?
Yes. Yes.
So he took us off. He spun us out.
That is so true. And I'm trying to remember the song. There's a tune.
Staircase Struggle.
Staircase Struggle, right. Sisyphean. It's like Sisyphus. It's like Staircase Struggle is exactly the sort of the tone, the feeling, the sensibility of what this song's about the carousel. You know, you're just constantly, and I was struck by that connection just now.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Amazing. So clearly the carousel keeps coming back and we're on this journey that keeps going up.
Yeah.
But the staircase, so the benefit of staircases, unlike a carousel, at least you're ascending, you know?
Except you never get there, so.
You never get there. I know.
It's to infinity. Like, it's like a conversation. It's like descending, descending, and then ascending, ascending. You know, like a conversation within itself, you know.
So Not So Fast was unreleased. First time listeners will be able to hear this, which is why you need to buy the whole box set. Garner wrote so much music, and we're just now, you know, being able to hear it. Original music is simply not released.
Amazing.
And this is such an opportunity.
I'm just so thankful for the work they're doing to make this music accessible for people, because it's so needed right now in our time for us to be reinvigorated with Earl Gardner's spirit, with his resilience, with his imagination, and his dexterity and his, you know, his fluid ability to just encounter and explore any environment, like, with sensibility. And it's this amazing combination of sensibility with imagination, I would say. Mm-hmm. Like, which is what we need. You know, it's like we have so much chaos right now, and the old structures are just, they're just dissolving because they're not working. They're not helping us, you know. And the institutions, like within the music itself, that have provided us with sustenance, like we need those things, you know what I mean?
Right.
And it's so hard now with not being able to have live music. But these recordings feel so live, you know?
Everything you described that Earl brings and that we need, you give us, you know?
Aww.
And it's certainly in your music. It's in your spirit. It's in your role as an educator, as a composer. And I think that, you know, you are definitely in that long trajectory of artists who are generous, and generous not just with, you know, people on the bandstand, but with the whole world around them who listen and are lifted by the music that you create. And I know that I mentioned Staircase Struggle from Mandorla Awakening 2. In some ways, it does speak to Earl Garner's entire struggle with Martha Glaser, because what I hear in that song is a kind of twist on Sisyphus, you know, pushing that boulder up the hill, a relentless struggle. But what you give us are lessons and creative ways to break that cycle. And so, you know, you in this role, the resurrection of Earl Garner's music is an opportunity to break the cycle and to create the kind of opening that I think artists have been trying to make from time immemorial. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And it's really been a lot of fun talking with you and listening to this music. And I'm really happy with what you're doing to support Earl Garner's legacy. It's really important, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Bye.
Earl Garner Uncovered is a production of Octave Music. Our show is produced and edited by me, Pete Lockhart, with Michael Saltzman and Alex Arif. Our executive producer is Susan Rosenberg. You can find the newly expanded and remastered edition of Feeling is Believing anywhere you listen to music, and get more info on our whole series and the new box set Liberation and Swing at earlgarner.com. On our next episode, Dr. Kelly is joined by Grammy-winning singer and multidisciplinary artist Cecile McLaurin-Sylvant for a journey through Garner's 1972 album, Gemini. Subscribe now. You won't want to miss it.